The evacuation of the hospital caught him by surprise. They hadn't told him. He overheard the orderlies making plans for the morning. He got out immediately. There were no guards, just an orderly, by chance, loitering on the perimeter. The orderly cost him a precious bottle of water broken across his head, but didn't delay him by more than a second. His long journey home started right there, a yard into the undergrowth outside the hospital fence. First task was to retrieve his money. It was buried 50 miles away, in a secret spot outside his last base camp, inside a coffin. The coffin was just a lucky chance. It had been the only large receptacle he could lay his hands on at the time, but later it would prove to be a stroke of absolute genius. The money was all in hundreds and fifties and twenties and tens, and there was 170 pounds of it. A plausible weight to find in a coffin. Just under $2 million. By then the base camp was abandoned and far behind enemy lines, but he got himself there and faced the first of his many difficulties. How does a sick, one-armed man dig up a coffin? At first, with blind perseverance. Then, later, with help. He had already shifted most of the earth when he was discovered. The coffin lid was plainly visible, lying in the shallow grave. The VC patrol crashed in on him out of the trees, and he expected to die. But he didn't. Instead, he made a discovery. It ranked with the other great discoveries he made in his life. The VC stood back, fearful and muttering and uncertain. He realized they didn't know who he was. They didn't know what he was. The terrible burns robbed him of his identity. He was wearing a torn and filthy hospital nightshirt. He didn't look American. He didn't look like anything. He didn't look human. He learned that the combination of his terrible looks and his wild behavior and the coffin had an effect on anybody who saw him. Distant, atavistic fears of death and corpses and madness made them passive. He learned in an instant, if he was prepared to act like a madman and cling to his coffin, these people would do anything for him. Their ancient superstitions worked in his favor. The VC patrol completed the excavation for him and loaded the coffin onto a buffalo cart. He sat up high on top of it and raved and gibbered and pointed west, and they took him 100 miles towards Cambodia. Vietnam is a narrow country side to side. He was passed from group to group and was in Cambodia within 4 days. They fed him rice and gave him water to drink and clothed him in black pajamas to tame him and assuage their primitive fears. Then Cambodians took him onward. He bounced and jabbered like a monkey and pointed west, west, west. 2 months later, he was in Thailand. The Cambodians manhandled the coffin over the border and turned and ran. Thailand was different. When Hobi passed the border, it was like stepping out of the Stone Age. There were roads and vehicles. The people were different. The babbling, scarred man with the coffin was an object for wary pity and concern. He was not a threat. He got rides on old Chevrolet pickups and in old Peugeot trucks, and within 2 weeks he found himself washed up with all the other Far Eastern flotsam in the sewer they called Bangkok. He lived in Bangkok for a year. He reburied the coffin in the yard behind the shack he rented, working furiously all through his first night with a black market entrenching tool stolen from the U.S. Army. He could manage an entrenching tool. It was designed to be used one-handed, while the other hand held a rifle. Once his money was safe again, he went looking for doctors. There was a large supply in Bangkok, gin-soaked remnants of empire, fired from every other job they ever had, but reasonably competent on the days they were sober. There wasn't much they could do with his face. A surgeon rebuilt his eyelid so that it would almost close, and that was it. But they were thorough with his arm, They opened the wound again and filed the bones round and smooth. They stitched the muscle down and folded the skin over tight and sealed it all back up. They told him to let it heal for a month, and then they sent him to a man who built false limbs. The man offered him a choice of styles. They all involved the same corset to be worn around the bicep, the same straps, the same cup molded to the exact contours of his stump, but there were different appendages. There was a wooden hand carved with great skill and painted by his daughter. There was a three-prong thing, like some kind of a gardening tool, but he chose the simple hook. It appealed to him, though he couldn't explain why. The man forged it from stainless steel and polished it for a week. He welded it to a funnel-shaped steel sheet and built the sheet into the heavy leather cup. He carved a wooden replica of the stump and beat the leather into shape over it, and then he soaked it in resins to make it stiff. He sewed the corset and attached the straps and buckles. He fitted it carefully and charged $500 American for it. He lived out the year in Bangkok. At first the hook chafed and was clumsy and uncontrollable, but he got better with it. With practice, he got along. By the time he dug up the coffin again and booked passage to San Francisco on a tramp steamer, he had forgotten all about ever having two hands. It was his face that continued to bother him. He landed in California and retrieved the coffin from the cargo sheds and used a small portion of its contents to buy a used station wagon. A trio of frightened longshoremen loaded the coffin inside, and he drove it cross-country, all the way to New York City. And he was still there 29 years later, with the Bangkok craftsman's handiwork lying on the floor beside his bed, where it had lain every night for the last 11,000 nights. He rolled over onto his front and reached down with his left hand and picked it up, sat up in bed and laid it across his knees and reached out to take the baby's sock from his nightstand. 6:10 in the morning. Another day of his life. William Curry woke up at 6:15. It was an old habit from working the day shift on the detective squads. He had inherited the lease on his grandmother's apartment 2 floors above Beekman Street. It wasn't a great apartment, but it was cheap, and it was convenient from most of the precinct houses below Canal. So he had moved in after his divorce and stayed there after his retirement. His police pension covered the rent and the utilities and the lease on his one-room office on Fletcher. So the income from his fledgling private bureau had to cover his food and his alimony. And then, when he got established and built it up bigger, it was supposed to make him rich. 6:15 in the morning. The apartment was cool. It was shaded from the early sun by taller buildings nearby. He put his feet on the linoleum and stood up and stretched. Went to the kitchen corner and set the coffee going. Headed to the bathroom and washed up. It was a routine that had always gotten him to work by 7 o'clock, and he stuck to it. He came back to the closet with coffee in his hand and stood there with the door open, looking at what was on the rail. As a cop, he had always been a pants-and-jacket type of guy. Gray flannels, check sport coat. He had favored tweed, although he wasn't strictly Irish. In the summer, he had tried linen jackets, but they wrinkled too easily, and he had settled on thin polyester blends. But none of those outfits was going to do on a day when he had to show up somewhere looking like David Forster, high-priced attorney. He was going to have to use his wedding suit. It was a plain black Brooks Brothers, bought for family weddings and christenings and funerals. It was 15 years old. And being Brooks Brothers didn't look a whole lot different from contemporary items. It was a little loose on him, because losing his wife's cooking had brought his weight down in a hurry. The pants were a little wide by East Village standards, but that was okay because he planned on wearing 2 ankle holsters. William Curry was a guy who believed in being prepared. David Forster had said, "Probably won't be anything involved at all." And if it worked out that way, he would be happy enough. But a 20-year man from the NYPD's worst years tends to get cautious when he hears a promise like that, so he planned on using both ankle holsters and putting his big .357 in the small of his back. He put the suit in a plastic cover he had picked up somewhere, and added a white shirt and his quietest tie. He threaded the .357 holster onto a black leather belt and put it in a bag with the two ankle holsters. He put three handguns in his briefcase, the .357 long-barreled Magnum and two .38 snub-nosed Smith & Wessons for the ankles. He sorted 12 rounds for each gun into a box and packed it beside the guns. He stuffed a black sock into each of his black shoes and stowed them with the holsters. He figured he would get changed after an early lunch, no point in wearing the stuff all morning and showing up looking like a limp rag. He locked up the apartment and walked south to his office on Fletcher, carrying his luggage, stopping only to get a muffin, banana and walnut, reduced fat. Marilyn Stone woke up at 7 o'clock. She was bleary-eyed and tired. They had been kept out of the bathroom until well after midnight. It had to be cleaned. The thick-set guy in the dark suit did it. He came out in a bad temper and made them wait until the floor dried. They sat in the dark and the silence, numb and cold and hungry, too sickened to think about asking for something to eat. Tony made Marilyn plump up the sofa pillows. She guessed he planned to sleep there. Bending over in her short dress and preparing his bed was a humiliation. She patted the pillows into place while he smiled at her. The bathroom was cold. It was damp everywhere and smelled of disinfectant. The towels had been folded and stacked next to the sink. She put them in two piles on the floor, and she and Chester curled up on them without a word. Beyond the door, the office was silent. She didn't expect to sleep, but she must have, because she awoke with a clear sense of a new day beginning. There were sounds in the office. She had rinsed her face and was standing upright when the thick-set guy brought coffee. She took her mug without a word, and he left Chester's on the ledge under the mirror. Chester was still on the floor, not asleep, just lying there, inert. The guy stepped right over him on his way out.
"Nearly over," she said.
"Just starting, you mean," Chester said back. "Where do we go next? Where do we go tonight?"
She was going to say, "Home, thank God." But then she remembered he'd already realized that after about 2:30 they would have no home.
"A hotel, I guess," she said.
"They took my credit cards."
Then he went quiet. She looked at him.
"What?"
"It's never going to be over," he said. "Don't you see that? We're witnesses to what they did to those cops. And Cheryl. How can they just let us walk away?"
She nodded, a small, vague movement of her head, and looked down at him with disappointment. She was disappointed because he finally understood. Now he was going to be worried and frantic all day, and that would just make it harder. It took 5 minutes to get the knot in the necktie neat, and then he slipped his jacket on. Dressing was the exact reverse of undressing, which meant the shoes came last. He could tie laces just about as fast as a two-handed person. The trick was to trap the loose end under the hook against the floor. Then he started in the bathroom. He rammed all the dirty laundry into a pillowcase and left it by the apartment door. He stripped the bed and balled the linen into another pillowcase. He put all the personal items he could find into a supermarket carrier. He emptied his closet into a garment bag. He propped the apartment door open and carried the pillowcases and the carrier to the refuse chute. Dropped them all down and clanged the slot closed after them. Dragged the garment bag out into the hallway and locked up the apartment and put the keys in an envelope from his pocket. He detoured to the concierge's desk and left the envelope of keys for the real estate guy. He used the stairway to the parking garage and carried the garment bag over to the Cadillac. He locked it into the trunk and walked around to the driver's door, slid inside, and leaned over with his left hand and fired it up. Squealed around the garage and up into the daylight. He drove south on Fifth, carefully averting his eyes until he was clear of the park and safe in the bustling canyons of Midtown. He leased 3 bays under the World Trade Center, but the Suburban was gone and the Tahoe was gone, so they were all empty when he arrived. He put the Cadillac in the middle slot and left the garment bag in the trunk. He figured he would drive the Cadillac to LaGuardia and abandon it in the long-term parking lot. Then he would take a cab to JFK, carrying the bag, looking like any other transfer passenger in a hurry. The car would sit there until the weeds grew up under it, and if anybody ever got suspicious, they would comb through the LaGuardia manifests, not JFK's. It meant writing off the Cadillac along with the lease on the offices, but he was always comfortable about spending money when he got value for it, and saving his life was about the best value he could think of getting.